May at the Headwaters Peace Center. HUF is an inclusive space to seek truth, practice love, and celebrate life. Learn more at headwatersuu.org.
The smell of blood mixed with gunpowder and burning flesh is returned once more in Gaza.
New Israeli airstrikes and new questions about a return to war in Gaza.
Today is Tuesday, March 18th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. This hour, the latest from Columbia University after federal immigration agents showed up to arrest non-citizen students.
Also, USAID was a bedrock for nonprofits and UN agencies.
Now they're trying to figure out how to work without US leadership.
Now, I don't believe you build a golden age by retreating from the world. But we do have to recognize the context which governments are taking these decisions in.
And we drop by a yoga class at an elephant ranch near Tampa.
I could feel the energy as we're doing this. I had to keep opening my eyes. This is amazing.
Now News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. Two NASA astronauts are home after more than 9 months in space. Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams splashed down just moments ago in their SpaceX capsule off the coast of Florida. A recovery vessel is en route. Following a highly anticipated phone call today, President Trump and Russian leader Vladimir Putin agreed to a partial ceasefire in Ukraine, yet the two leaders failed to agree Trump's more expansive ceasefire and peace proposals. NPR's Charles Maines reports.
Both the White House and the Kremlin praised talks between Putin and Trump as an open and frank 2.5-hour exchange focused on Ukraine and U.S.-Russian relations. The most significant outcome, Putin agreed to a 30-day halt on strikes on all energy infrastructure in Ukraine. However, the talks fell short on Trump's proposal for a wider ceasefire in all land, sea, and air attacks, a proposal Kyiv had previously accepted. A Kremlin statement maintains any broader resolution would hinge on an end to all Western military aid and intelligence support to Ukraine, but that's an unlikely scenario given Kyiv currently receives backing from not only the U.S., but its allies in Europe. Charles Maines, NPR News.
A federal judge has ruled Elon Musk and his government cost-cutting entity Doge likely violated the Constitution in dismantling the United States Agency for International Development. NPR's Fatma Tana says more.
More than two dozen current or recently fired employees of USAID sued Elon Musk and Doge, challenging the accelerated shutdown of the agency. In a 68-page opinion, U.S. District Judge Theodore Chuang ruled in favor of the plaintiffs and ordered Doge to reinstate email access to current agency employees and block them from taking any actions relating to the agency without the approval of a duly appointed USAID officer. The judge said the actions to shut down USAID and permanently close its headquarters, and that it, quote, deprived Congress of their constitutional authority over an agency created by Congress. Fatma Tanis, NPR News.
Democratic congressional leaders are facing frustration from the party base after the party failed to block a GOP spending bill to fund the government. NPR's Domenico Montanaro looks at the battle within the party.
Democrats are really struggling to find their way out of the political wilderness and how to oppose President Trump. Most immediately, the party has to figure out how to be united ahead of the 2026 midterm elections. Remember, those elections are lower turnout affairs than presidential elections, and activism really matters. So Democrats can't alienate their base if they want to have any hope of taking back the House. And then, of course, there's 2028, and that's just going to be a really open contest with lots of candidates ranging from far left to moderate progressives vying to be the person who can make the argument about the vision going forward that best represents Democratic big D values. Domenico Montanaro, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow was down 260 points. This is NPR. Speaking at the start of the developers conference today, the head of chipmaker NVIDIA said AI is currently going through an inflection point. NVIDIA founder Jensen Huang telling attendees demand for GPUs from the top four cloud service providers is surging, that he expects NVIDIA's infrastructure revenue to reach the $1 trillion mark by 2028. He also announced automaker GM will integrate NVIDIA technology into its new fleet of self-driving vehicles. The presidents of Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo have held face-to-face talks hosted by Qatar to address the conflict in eastern DRC. Since January, the Rwandan-backed M23 rebel group has advanced, taking over much of the eastern region near the border with Rwanda, appears Emmanuel Akinwuto reports.
DRC President Felix Tshisekedi and Rwandan President Paul Kagame met in the capital city of Doha. The meeting was not pre-announced and came amid faltering diplomatic efforts to end the crisis in eastern DRC. The conflict is partly a legacy of the 1994 genocide in Rwanda, leading to prolonged tensions between the two countries. The Qatari Foreign Ministry says the meeting, quote, helped build confidence in a shared commitment to a secure and stable future. The UN and several countries, including the US, have accused Rwanda of supporting the M23 rebel group and exploiting DRC's resources. Emmanuel Akinwotu, NPR News, Lagos.
The last known surviving pilot to take part in the Battle of Britain has died, according to the Royal Air Force. John Paddy Hemingway was just 20 years old when he and comrades took to the skies to fight off a wave of Nazi aircraft in 1940. He was 105. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation. For nearly a century, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. More at mott.org. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
6 minutes after 5 o'clock, you're listening to All Things Considered on KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 5:30, the Up North Report, local news from our region. You can also find more local stories at our website, kaxe.org. We've received support from Lake Country Power, a Touchstone Energy cooperative committed to community and giving back through scholarships, youth programs, Operation Roundup, and more. Lake Country Power, made by the community for the community.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. The Israeli military says the ceasefire with Hamas in Gaza is officially over, and a new offensive against the militant group there has begun. That's after a series of surprise Israeli airstrikes overnight killed more than 400 Palestinians, many of them children, and injured hundreds more. That's according to health officials there. It has been one of the deadliest days in Gaza since the war began more than 17 months ago. I want to bring in NPR's Kat Lonsdorf, who's been following this from Tel Aviv. Hey, Kat.
Hey, Mary Louise.
So Israel announcing the end of the ceasefire, which the ceasefire had been fragile, but it also had allowed for what passes for relative quiet over these last couple of months in Gaza. What more do we know?
Well, earlier this evening, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu addressed the country. He said that Israel had exhausted every effort through negotiations to bring the remaining hostages back to Israel. He said that Hamas had rejected every offer Israel had put forward to make that happen. I should note, Hamas says that's not true. Netanyahu said a return to war was the only option left, and warned that the strikes in Gaza today were just the beginning. From this point forward, he said, Israel will act against Hamas with increasing force. He added that further negotiations will only take place while fighting is happening. Earlier today, the Israeli military posted on social media ordering Palestinians from several neighborhoods in Gaza to evacuate immediately to avoid imminent strikes that it said were targeting Hamas. You know, these are the kinds of orders that were issued constantly before the ceasefire, displacing Palestinians over and over again.
Well, and I'm wondering, why now? Why is Israel launching these airstrikes now?
So Israel says these strikes were targeting senior Hamas officials and that this new offensive is to pressure Hamas to accept a proposal by President Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, for the release of more Israeli hostages. Just to be clear, the Witkoff plan that they're pushing is different than the original deal that both sides agreed to back in January. The first phase of that deal expired at the beginning of this month. Hamas has been pushing to go to the second phase of that plan, but Israel is now demanding the Witkoff plan. Meanwhile, there are a lot of internal Israeli politics at work here. Netanyahu has been under a lot of pressure from far-right members of his government to return to war in Gaza. Many here feel like today was Netanyahu playing into those pressures.
What kind of response are you tracking so far from Hamas?
Hamas has confirmed that five of its high-level members were killed in these overnight strikes. The militant group has also warned that these strikes are putting the remaining Israeli hostages in Gaza in danger and leaving them to a, quote, unknown fate. In terms of ceasefire proposals, senior Hamas official Bassem Naim told NPR today that it has not rejected that Witkoff proposal, even though it's different from what was originally agreed upon. He said the group remains committed to an agreement, but he also said that he believed that there would be a retaliation by Hamas on Israel for the strikes earlier today.
I mean, you always have to think about the ordinary people caught in the middle of this. People in Gaza, yeah, where we said more than 400 Palestinians were killed today. And this after more than 2 weeks of an Israeli blockade on aid. What was it like there today?
So NPR's producer in Gaza, Anas Baba, was at the Al Ahli Hospital in Gaza City this morning. He described a chaotic scene. The courtyard of the hospital was filled with dozens of bodies, many of them children, you know, people crying. Many he talked to were in shock. They couldn't believe that the war had started again. One man he talked to, Suleiman Grega, he was at the hospital after being pulled from the rubble with his wife. He said the house next door to them, where much of his extended family lived, was directly hit and many of them were killed. I was expecting the ceasefire to continue and for things to get better, he says. We need the world to intervene.
And very briefly, Kat, what are you hearing from people there in Israel?
So polls show that a majority of Israelis do not want to return to war. They want a renewal of the talks and for the remaining hostages to be released from Gaza. There were protests all across the country demanding that. You know, many of the hostage family members feel that Netanyahu is basically forsaking the hostages and leaving them to die in Gaza.
NPR's Kat Lonsdorf in Tel Aviv. Thanks, Kat.
Thank you.
The Trump administration continues to double down on its use of the Alien Enemies Act. This act is a rare wartime power used to deport non-citizens with little or no due process. And it's what the Trump administration used to defend its decision to deport more than 130 migrants over the weekend to El Salvador. A federal court has asked the Trump administration for more details on these deportations. And today, President Trump lashed out at the judge on that case, prompting a rare rebuke from the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. NPR's Sergio Martinez Beltran has been following all of the back and forth and joins us now. Hi, Sergio.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, so let's start with what the court has asked for here. Some new details, right, on these three deportation flights. What more have we learned about those flights?
Well, it was an order from federal judge James Boasberg. The judge is questioning whether the Trump administration violated his orders from Saturday to turn around the flights carrying alleged members of Tren de Aragua, a U.S.-designated foreign terror group originating in Venezuela. So yesterday, Judge Boasberg asked the Trump administration to answer four detailed questions about the deportation flights. Today, the administration partially complied. The DOJ provided a sworn declaration that no one was deported after Judge Boasberg's written order under the Alien Enemies Act.
Okay, and has the judge responded to those details from the Trump administration? Yeah.
Yes, Boasberg quickly said he still wants more details about the first two flights. He ordered a response by noon tomorrow. He wants to know when the flights left U.S. airspace and when they landed in El Salvador. He also wants to know how many people aboard were subject to the Alien Enemies Act. Judge Boasberg has also set a hearing for Friday. That will center on the Trump administration's effort to nullify the federal restraining order blocking the White House from deporting more alleged Venezuelan gang members under the Alien Enemies Act.
Okay, and as we mentioned, President Trump got personally involved in this case. Tell us more about what he said exactly.
President Trump today lashed out at Judge Boasberg. He called the judge a, quote, radical left lunatic on a social media post and called for him to be impeached. That prompted a strong and rare public rebuke from Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts. In a statement, Roberts said impeachment is, quote, not an appropriate response to disagreement concerning a judicial decision.
Wow. Okay. Well, what do we know so far about the people who were sent to El Salvador?
So, not much, Elsa. Neither the Trump administration or the government of El Salvador has provided a list of names, but family members have started to identify their loved ones through photos and videos posted online. I talked to Mirelis Cacique Lopez. She's in Maracay, Venezuela. She says her son, Francisco García Cacique, was one of the people sent to El Salvador.
¿De qué hablan ellos? No tienen, ¿dónde están las pruebas de lo que ellos dicen?
Where's the evidence? Cacique asks. She says her son is not Tren de Aragua and has no criminal record. NPR was unable to confirm that. His mom tells me he did sign a deportation order, but they both thought he was going to be sent back to Venezuela, not a prison in El Salvador.
Siento que fuimos muy ingenuos porque nosotros confiamos en ese país que le iba a respetar sus derechos.
I feel we were naive, she says. We trusted that the U.S. was going to respect his rights. In court filings, Elsa, the U.S. government admitted that many of the people on these flights, the administration claims are Tren de Aragua, do not have criminal records in the U.S. The government claims, quote, the lack of specific information about each individual actually highlights the risk they pose, end quote.
That is NPR's Sergio Martinez Beltran. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You may have heard of yoga with goats. In Florida, you can now do yoga with elephants, or near them, at least. Carrie Sheridan from member station WUSF reports.
Dan Bew, a 50-year-old retired Navy veteran, remembers when he first heard about elephant yoga.
I'm going to go do yoga outside on the grass, and there's going to be animals there. Okay, I'm still doing yoga.
That was a few years ago. Now he teaches it.
Exhale. Hands down to side body, palms facing up.
On a recent morning, he led a class of about 80 people outside under the soft sunlight at the Myakka Elephant Ranch south of Tampa.
On your next inhale, begin to bring that right knee in towards the chest.
The people stretch on mats on the lawn. Three elephants amble out of their barn and mosey around in the open air. To be clear, the elephants are not doing yoga with them. They're nearby, safely behind a double wire fence.
We have three elephants right now.
That's Lou Bereda, owner of the ranch.
They're all retired. They mostly did entertainment throughout their lives.
After a life in the circus and on movie sets, they now twirl hay with their trunks, kind of like spaghetti on a fork, and scoop it into their mouths. Even though the elephants are not doing any downward dogs or chaturangas, Bereda thinks they get something out of the class.
Seeing new people, new smells every day really kind of enriches them. They love being outside, but they also like things to do. So even with the yoga kind of in the background, they do notice.
As we come into a Sphinx pose.
The students prop themselves up on their elbows. Facing them, behind the fence, is an elephant with long white tusks flapping her ears. After class, Nancy Ross says she was mesmerized.
I could feel the energy as we're doing this. I had to keep opening my eyes. This is amazing.
The classes are free for veterans like her.
I am a Navy vet, anti-submarine warfare. It's got a little PTSD going on.
Most who come here are civilians who pay a fee to benefit Operation Warrior Resolution. They help veterans resolve trauma. Scott Schwalm is the director of programming.
Most of us are addicted to racing thoughts and ruminating over the past or the future.
It turns out watching elephants while stretching kind of helps with that.
This is a great exercise of being in the now.
A time for elephants and humans alike to breathe and take in the beauty around. For NPR News, I'm Carrie Sheridan in Myakka City, Florida.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. It is 5:18. I'm Jennifer Barr. At 5:30, the Up North Report, local news from our region. Coming up at 6 o'clock, As It Happens, news from a Canadian perspective. And 7 o'clock, Malachi Coons, your host for On the River, bringing you a great mix of music. We receive support from the Bonner Eye Clinic with locations in Grand Rapids and Hibbing, welcoming Dr. Carlisle to their team, offering lid and cataract surgery, general eye exams, and more. BonnerEyeClinic.com, let us help you see clearly. We also thank ICTV. ICTV connects, informs, and empowers the community through diverse media. Learn more at watchictv.org. The Bemidji Public Library and Lake Bemidji State Park present a recipe swap and a discussion of the Good Berry Cookbook this Saturday, 2 p.m. The State Park's artisan residents will assist in decorating recipes as well. Again, that's happening at the Bemidji Public Library. Heartland Symphony presents a concert this Sunday, March 23rd at 2:30 at the Gitche Zibe Center for the Arts in Brainerd. It will feature the world premiere of Ian T. Jones's film music, a piece inspired by the band Radiohead. The Minnesota Discovery Center in Chisholm hosts Fossils, Fossils, Fossils on Saturday, March 29th from 11 to 4. Explore real fossils from the Iron Range and enjoy dino snacks. Coming up tomorrow at 8:10 on the Wednesday Morning Show, the Beltrami County Master Gardeners will join Andrew DeZingle and Jen Kellen for their monthly segment, Twist and Sprout. This month's topic is houseplants. If you have any questions about that, you can text us 218-326-1234. There is more ahead from All Things Considered on People Powered KAXE.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Time is running out for people who rely on cheaper alternatives for a name-brand obesity drug. Large specialty pharmacies that were allowed to essentially make copies of Zepbound have to stop tomorrow. NPR Pharmaceuticals correspondent Cindy Lepkin has more on how patients are dealing with the change.
Christina and Jackson Agar, a couple in Minnesota, used to order a pizza and finish it in one night. But an obesity drug changed that.
We ate some of it the first night, and then the next day we had maybe a little bit more. And then we ended up throwing the pizza away because it had gone past the days that you could eat it. And it was so strange because we have never done that.
No, never.
They've each lost about 20 pounds in 6 weeks. But they're not taking Eli Lilly's Zepbound. Their insurance doesn't cover it. They're taking a cheaper alternative that contains the active ingredient called tirzepatide. It's made by a compounding pharmacy, which is a special kind of pharmacy that's allowed to essentially make copies of drugs during shortages. Christina says she has more energy for their four kids. And Jackson stopped needing to use his sleep apnea machine.
It is completely life-changing to take a bite of these triggering foods and just be like, enjoy it. Say, yep, that was good. Yep. And now I'm full.
And now, yeah.
But on March 19th, the Food and Drug Administration says compounding pharmacies will have to stop making tirzepatide because the agency declared the year-long Zepbound shortage over. The Agars are worried. Other patients are sad. Some more are just angry. In Arizona, Margot Carmichael was in denial.
I thought what I think a lot of people perhaps did, oh, it'll be fine. These compounding and telehealth places are making millions off of this and helping so many people. There's no way this is going to stop being available.
It's been confusing for patients. Some telehealth companies have been telling them they won't be affected. Others have been offering last-minute sales as the FDA deadline nears.
So March 19th, we are essentially done.
That's Josh Fritzler, the chief financial officer for Olympia Pharmaceuticals, a large compounding pharmacy in Orlando.
We can make enough in the time being to fill patient scripts.
Smaller compounding pharmacies, which are regulated by states, were supposed to stop in February. Many patients told NPR they have been stocking up on compounded tirzepatide. Carmichael doesn't have health insurance right now. She says she can only afford a small stockpile.
I don't have the money, so I'm going to borrow the money and try to get 3 more months and stretch it out as long as I can and hope that 6 to 9 months from now, there'll be another solution.
Eli Lilly sells Zepbound vials at a discount for people not using insurance. But Carmichael says they're still too expensive. She would have to pay $600 for a month's supply from Lilly. She's been able to get 3 months of compounded vials for $500. To keep the Lilly discount, patients like Carmichael would also have to renew every 45 days.
They're making it as difficult as possible for people.
Some people are talking online about buying the active ingredient from China and mixing the obesity drugs in their homes. They call it the gray market. Here's Jackson Agar in Minnesota.
Look, when you ban stuff, people are going to turn to crazy alternatives because we need this and we don't have that much money.
But he says the gray market is a risk his family is just unwilling to take. Sydney Lupkin, NPR News.
at Columbia University in New York. Anger and frustration is reaching a boiling point as federal immigration agents have shown up to arrest and deport non-citizen students who have participated in pro-Palestinian protests. Students and faculty warn that President Trump's crackdown will not end with Columbia. NPR's Adrian Florido reports from New York.
Hundreds of students recently gathered at Columbia University's main gates, their faces wrapped in Palestinian keffiyeh scarves, and they marched. Federal immigration agents arrested Mahmoud Khalil, a graduate student and legal permanent resident, on March 8th. He was a leader of pro-Palestinian protests on campus last year. The Trump administration revoked his green card and said it plans to deport him. The president said on social media Khalil's activism was anti-Semitic and aligned with Hamas terrorism, which Khalil denies. He's being held in Louisiana. President Trump said he was the first arrest of many to come. A few days later, immigration agents searched the campus apartments of two other students they were looking for. The school let them in. One student had already fled to Canada. The school's interim president, Katrina Armstrong, said in a school-wide email that she was heartbroken, but she said the agents had warrants. Protesters are having none of it.
Columbia, we need more than heartbroken. We need real protection.
This protester declined to give his name out of fear of being targeted.
What kind of school, what kind of workplace leaves workers and students vulnerable to politically motivated kidnapping in their own homes?
As the Trump administration targets non-citizen students who've protested Israel and the war in Gaza, students are growing angry their school isn't publicly fighting back. Tasmina is a recent Columbia graduate. She gave NPR only her first name because she's been involved in the pro-Palestinian protests and worries about online harassment. She notes the school hasn't mentioned Khalil in any public statements.
You know, like sending emails about, you know, here are some resources, here are some counseling services. Is that really all that Columbia can do? That's all that they can offer, or just a link for counseling services, really?
It's not clear how effectively Columbia could push back. It's facing huge pressure from the Trump administration, which cut $400 million in federal funding for the school, saying it had failed to protect Jewish students from harassment during campus protests. It gave the school a list of demands to meet before it would consider restoring the funding. A congressional committee has also ordered Columbia to turn over the disciplinary records of students who participated in protests. In statements sent to NPR, Columbia said it follows the law and requires law enforcement to have a judicial warrant to enter non-public university areas. Sitting near the steps of Columbia's main library, Wyatt Nash, a freshman, said having immigration agents on campus has been scary. He's Jewish. He knows people on both sides of the Israeli-Palestinian debate. But he says Khalil's arrest united many of them.
When that happened, it felt like every single person, no matter what you believed, was like, everyone should have a right to speak their mind and what they believe, and subjects shouldn't be punished for that, you know?
Vocal pro-Israel students at Columbia have celebrated the Trump administration's broader crackdown over anti-Semitism. NPR reached out to several to ask how they feel about Khalil's arrest. They either did not respond or declined to speak about that. Ava Kreitziger, a freshman, says she understands the bind administrators are in as the Trump administration uses funding cuts to pressure the school.
But at the same time, the people should be the priority rather than donors and money. And so I think there should be more of a clear stance from the administration on where they stand, that they want to protect the students, and that they are behind us completely rather than compliance with Trump.
She thinks how Columbia University responds will signal to other schools whether and how they should fight back if immigration agents show up for their students. Adrian Florido, NPR News, New York.
This is NPR News.
It's 5:29. Thank you for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, the Up North Report, local news from our region. We have a slight chance for flurries before midnight and our lows overnight ranging from 22 to 29. Partly sunny tomorrow with highs in the mid-30s and breezy northwest winds 10 to 20 gusting up to 30 miles per hour. For Thursday, sunny with highs in the mid-40s.
For KAXE News, I'm Chelsea Perkins with the Up North Report. The following report involves details that may be upsetting for some listeners. Minnesota State Senator Justin Eichhorn of Grand Rapids is in police custody Tuesday after he was arrested on suspicion of attempting to solicit a minor for sex. Typically, KAXE News would not name someone accused of a crime before they've appeared in court, but we are naming Eichhorn because of the serious nature of the allegation and his prominence as an elected official. The Bloomington Police Department announced in a news release that the 40-year-old Republican was arrested Monday night after communicating with a Bloomington detective pretending to be a 16-year-old girl online. Police report that Eichhorn was observed arriving by pickup truck to meet the girl and was arrested without incident outside of his vehicle by uniformed officers. He was booked into the Bloomington Police Department jail and was set to be transported to the Hennepin County Adult Detention Center, according to authorities. Eichhorn had not yet been charged as of the time of the Tuesday news release. Eichhorn has represented the Grand Rapids area since 2016 and was reelected in 2020 and 2022. Senate District 6 also now includes most of Crow Wing County, including Brainerd and Baxter, and eastern Cass County. In February, he was named the chairman of the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Board. Tuesday afternoon, both parties released statements demanding Eichhorn's immediate resignation. In a statement posted to Facebook, the Minnesota Senate Republican Caucus writes, quote, "We are shocked by these reports, and this alleged conduct demands an immediate resignation. Justin has a difficult road ahead, and he needs to focus on his family." And Minnesota DFL Executive Director Heidi Krause-Kaplan says, quote, "No one who solicits children belongs anywhere near public office or the state capitol." Check KAXE.org for the latest information on this ongoing investigation. One of the men accused of involvement in the theft of Dorothy's ruby slippers from the Judy Garland Museum in Grand Rapids has died. The Star Tribune reports that 77-year-old Jerry Hal Sliderman, who allegedly buried the iconic movie props in his own backyard for years, died on Sunday. His death closes the federal case against him after he was indicted by a grand jury a year ago. He was charged with theft of major artwork. The Crystal Man had COPD and Parkinson's disease, according to court filings. The slippers were uncovered during a sting operation in Minneapolis in July 2018. They were one of four pairs worn by Garland in The Wizard of Oz and were on loan to the museum at the time of the 2005 theft. The Minnesota Department of Transportation will host two open houses next week on the upcoming Highway 210 roadwork project in Brainerd, planned for 2026 and 27. The events will be noon to 2 p.m. and 4 to 6 p.m. on March 25th at the Crow Wing County Land Services Building. People who attend will have an opportunity to meet the project team, ask questions, and learn about tentative work and detour plans and routes. The estimated $51.3 million project will reconstruct and update both directions of Highway 210, also known as Washington Street. Work next year will be on the eastern section, including roundabouts and new connections, while 2027 will be on the western portion, including the Mississippi River Bridge. The last of the winter sports state tournaments kicks off Tuesday as boys basketball players from across Minnesota head to the Twin Cities to compete. Four teams from rural northern Minnesota won their section championships last week in their quest for the state title. The first to play from the Northland is Section 7-2A champs Pequot Lakes, set to face number 2-seeded Waseca at 6 p.m. Tuesday at the Target Center. The Patriots were the consolation final winners last year and are on a six-game winning spree headed into the quarterfinals. On Thursday, Class 1A teams will take the court. Number 1-seeded Cherry is the defending state champion in Class 1A and will play number 8 Bold at 11 a.m. Thursday. Cherry's only loss this season came to Section 8A champs Red Lake County, the number 3 seed, who will face number 6 Goodhue at 5 p.m. Thursday. This is Red Lake County's first state tourney appearance since 2017. 5A section champions Nevis got the number 4 seed and will play Henning at 1 p.m. Thursday. Nevis placed third last year and defeated Henning earlier in the season. That's it for the Up North Report from the KAXE News Desk. I'm Chelsea Perkins, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is made possible by Woodland Bank, serving the area since 1920 with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Woodland Bank believes in building community and serving local nonprofits like KAXE.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Amazon Business, offering business buying services, from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. Health disparity. That's among hundreds of terms the Trump administration is reportedly telling federal agencies to avoid or scrub from government websites, research, and databases. Some researchers, though, point out their work on health disparities actually benefits rural white populations that are often overlooked in debates about diversity and equity. NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports.
Dr. Fola May studies diseases of the digestive tract and runs a lab at the University of California, Los Angeles, looking for ways to detect disease earlier in various populations. For that work, her lab relies on federal funds from the National Institutes of Health and the Department of Veterans Affairs.
I would say I'm very dependent on it.
So as those agencies began canceling grants promoting diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI, May worried, would work like hers, looking at health disparities, also get swept in?
I'm terrified.
Addressing disparities has been a central focus of healthcare, and especially since the pandemic laid bare how access to care can affect so many aspects of health. May says that's abruptly shifted.
One of the biggest challenges right now is that people are becoming very polarized about disparities research, and they're thinking that, oh, there are resources that are going to groups that are not me.
That's a misconception, May says, citing her own research on cancer screenings.
We have to recognize that disparities are affecting everyone, not just racial and ethnic minorities. I'll give an example. White individuals that live in rural areas of the United States are less likely to get a screening test.
May says conflating health disparities with racial division or political advantages will discourage those like her trying to improve the health of people overall. And she worries about an uncertain sense of censorship that hovers over her research.
We aren't sure what we can say in our grants. I very freely before wrote about disparities and equity in my grants. Actually, the NIH had a requirement that you had to write about equity and disparities in every grant.
Across the nation's scientific communities, researchers say they feel confused and concerned.
It feels like there's no adults in the room.
That's Kay, a clinician who works at the VA. NPR agreed not to use her full name because she fears losing her job. She researches why rural veterans, and women in particular, see doctors less and die younger than counterparts in cities. Kay says colleagues circulated lists of words to avoid. But Kay says they include words like women, female, gender, and underserved, making it hard to accurately present data she's collected.
We're actively omitting really important details and hoping what we're reporting is still accurate, still authentic, and not misleading while threading this needle of not having the work flagged or torn down.
Electra Packett, a longtime cancer researcher at Ohio State University, has sought clarity.
Does it fall into the DEI category? You cannot contact them to get an answer.
She says her partners at NIH can't answer her questions because of a White House gag order still partially in effect. The NIH and VA did not respond to NPR's requests for comment. Paskett says work overcoming disparities in cancer care has dramatically increased survival. Yet she worries many voters and politicians may undermine that progress because they don't understand disparities.
We hope that that is not under attack, because if we want to cure cancer, we want to eliminate cancer, which is a bipartisan goal, then we have to make sure that we're addressing all populations.
Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
A federal judge has ruled that the Trump administration likely violated the Constitution when it effectively shuttered USAID. But in the meantime, the decision to gut USAID has upended humanitarian work around the globe. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports on the cascading effects of U.S. policy in Washington.
Five Sudanese children died of malnutrition on the day we reached Hanan Ahmed and her colleague in Khartoum, Abdullah Mohammed.
Yesterday, too, we lost. Before yesterday, every day we lost from Khartoum people.
Oh, this is something really bad, actually.
Hanan Ahmed, who's based in the U.S., founded the Emergency Response Room in Sudan. It's a network of local volunteers who support victims of sexual violence. It also runs soup kitchens.
We have 800 soup kitchens around Sudan, and 580 right now are completely dry.
She estimates that more than 70% of the funding comes from the U.S., not directly from USAID, but rather through nonprofit groups. Many of them receive money from the U.S. government. They were prepared for some Trump cuts, but no one expected this.
There is never a sense that the U.S. would completely withdraw from its global engagements this way.
Sam Worthington used to run Interaction, an umbrella organization of American non-governmental groups.
As if it chose to somehow disengage globally with its army or something, the scale of disengagement was so large that there was no way to ever plan for that.
Private nonprofits have had to cut back on services and staff around the globe. Worthington says this includes many faith-based groups who have yet to speak up publicly, but are trying to use their influence with members of Congress and the Trump administration.
They have been very candid behind closed doors about what is going on, that they're laying off, 30-40% of their staff, that individuals are starving to death because these programs are ending, that they cannot make up the slack.
The top humanitarian official at the UN says it's hard to quantify just what all this means, but Tom Fletcher says one thing is clear. Up to now, the U.S. has been a humanitarian superpower in the world, saving hundreds of millions of lives.
Now, I don't believe you build a golden age by retreating from the world, but we do have to recognize the context which governments are taking these decisions in. And of course, it's not just the American government. I'm spending a lot more of my time than I'd expected in other donor capitals, trying to shore up the case for what we do.
Andy says making brutal choices about where to focus resources when there are so many conflicts and disasters in the world.
We have to save as many lives as we can with the money that we have, not the money that we would like to have.
The UN says it is moving some offices out of New York and closer to the people they help, but the world body has been slow to react.
The dependence on U.S. funding increased even after the last Trump administration. I think there was a sense of, oh, we weathered the storm.
Erwin Loy is senior policy editor of The New Humanitarian, a nonprofit newsroom that focuses on this issue. He says the UN and private aid groups have relied too heavily on the U.S.
U.S. funding increased through the pandemic, through the COVID-19 pandemic. Poverty rates soared around the globe and there was a need for aid, and the U.S. was the one that stepped up.
And he doesn't see other wealthy nations filling the gaps in the system where, up to now, the U.S. has had the most influence.
If you're China, if you're Saudi Arabia, you don't give money to a multilateral system that you don't feel represents your interests.
European nations, too, have been cutting back on some of their humanitarian aid because they're under pressure from the Trump administration to spend more on defense. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The Rwandan government is widely believed to be backing the M23 rebel group that has taken over much of the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Rwanda denies it, but the DRC wants organizations around the world to break ties with Rwanda. NPR's Emmanuel Akinwutu reports.
Rwanda has emerged to show a different face to the world after over 30 years of rebuilding and progress since the profound horrors of the 1994 genocide.
This is amazing. Wow, Rwanda, Rwanda, I love you, Rwanda!
Masai Ujiri, president of the Toronto Raptors basketball team, on a visit to Rwanda, celebrating it as a premier destination and partner in Africa.
I love you, President Kagame. You are a friend. You are unbelievable.
Many like Ujiri have praised President Paul Kagame for transforming Rwanda to a nation on the rise.
Rwanda, stand up.
The country's partnership with the NBA is just one of many in the sports world alone. But these partnerships have come under scrutiny as criticism of Rwanda grows.
NBA Academy Africa is coming to Kigali.
The DRC has accused Rwanda of invading the east of the country and exploiting its minerals through a joint offensive with the M23 rebel group. Congolese officials say the M23 has killed more than 7,000 people since January, a figure that is impossible to independently verify.
I think the politicization of our sports partnership is unjustified and wrong.
Yolande Makolo is a spokeswoman for the Rwandan government. Visits Rwanda, a company funded by the government, promotes tourism to Rwanda and sponsors Paris Saint-Germain, Bayern Munich and Arsenal, some of the biggest soccer clubs in the world. But all three clubs have faced calls to suspend their deals.
It's blackmail, and we're going to challenge this and fight back.
Rwanda has accused the DRC of not doing enough to isolate and prosecute Hutu militias responsible for the 1994 genocide, where almost 1 million mostly Tutsis were killed. Many Hutu militias then fled across the border to DRC. Rwanda says it's defending Tutsi minorities, and it's denied backing the M23, but widespread evidence from UN experts and governments, including the US, has meant few believe them.
I don't think our partners should bow to this pressure because we're doing very good work together. I mean, as Africans, we're trying to grow economies so we can be less dependent on aid.
Last month, the US sanctioned James Kabarebe, a minister in Rwanda's government, for orchestrating Rwandan support for M23 and generating revenue from DRC's minerals. And on Monday, the European Union sanctioned a Rwandan gold refinery and several Rwandan military officials and M23 fighters.
Rwanda's most important export is its reputation.
Jason Stearns is a senior fellow at the Center on International Cooperation at New York University. He said the pressure on Rwanda is growing, but hasn't come close to what the country faced in the past. The US completely cut development aid following a similar offensive by M23 more than a decade ago.
Then there was much, much stiffer pressure on Rwanda brought to bear by the donor community.
But Rwanda has become an important partner to Western countries since then, including by providing military support for peacekeeping missions in places like Mozambique.
Rwanda has been able to make itself needed. I think that's one of the reasons that donor countries have been so reluctant to crack down on what nobody is questioning really is massive Rwandan intervention in Eastern DRC.
So for now, Rwanda's attraction to international organizations and governments alike appears to be shielding it from harsher sanctions, all while the M23 advances and millions in eastern DRC continue to pay the price. Emmanuel Akinwutu, NPR News, Lagos.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's 5:48. You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 6 o'clock, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective. We'll also sample our album of the week just after 6. Coming up at 7, Malachi Coons, your host for On the River, a great mix of music. We've received support from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org. Slight chance of flurries before midnight. Our lows tonight, 22 to 29. Partly sunny tomorrow with highs in the mid-30s and breezy north winds gusting up to 30 miles per hour. For Thursday, sunny, highs in the mid-40s. And for Friday, sunny, highs in the upper 30s to low 40s. We received support from the Mental Health Crisis Response Team of Itasca County. This crisis intervention service is a program of first call for help 211 and provides free crisis assessments, stabilization services, referrals, and resourcing to residents of any age who are in crisis. Available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week by dialing 211. Northland Arboretum is offering a tour of the maple syruping operation at Clay Hill Farm near Brainerd, Saturday, March 29th at either 9 a.m. or 1 p.m. Pre-registration required at northlandarb.org. There is a meatball dinner to benefit the Bagley Senior Center Sunday, March 23rd from 11 to 2 at the Bagley American Legion. Live music by Figuring It Out follows at 2 o'clock. All proceeds will go toward a new roof for the Bagley Senior Center. Elder Circle in Grand Rapids hosts AARP Foundation Tax Aid by appointment only now through April 11th. This tax preparation service is free for families and individuals of all ages. More news is next.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The Trump administration has ordered several changes to the way that the federal government does business. One of them is to remove a decades-old clause from the rules that federal contractors must follow. The clause, which dates back to the 1960s, explicitly banned companies from maintaining segregated facilities. Well, companies that contract with the federal government still need to comply with current laws that prohibit segregation and discrimination. Experts say the removal of this decades-old contract clause is significant. NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin has this exclusive story.
The change came in a public memo issued last month by the General Services Administration and affects contracts from all agencies of the federal government. In the memo, William Clark, director of the Office of Government-Wide Acquisition Policy, explained that the GSA was prompted by President Trump's executive orders on diversity, equity, and inclusion, and the one about gender identity. It includes a list of 9 clauses to exclude in future contracts. The way the change was made was unusual. Cara Sacolato of the law firm Wiley in Washington, D.C. says normally a panel would come together to propose a rule to implement an executive order.
Send it out for notice and comment, and then parties have a chance to comment on it. Then it is put in a final rule that is then inserted into the FAR.
The FAR stands for Federal Acquisition Regulation, government-wide policies and laws on procurement. That is not what happened here. Instead, the changes went into effect immediately with no opportunity for public comment, a procedure that's usually reserved for national emergencies. One particular clause on the list to be excluded from contracts going forward is called, quote, prohibition of segregated facilities, which reads, quote, the contractor agrees that it does not and will not maintain or provide for its employees any segregated facilities at any of its establishments. It defines segregated facilities as work areas, restaurants, drinking fountains, transportation, housing, and more. And it says you can't segregate based on, quote, race, color, religion, sex, sexual orientation, gender identity, or national origin. Sacolato notes that gender identity was added to the clause in 2015 under President Obama.
I would suspect that that is the reason why this one got identified on the list. That's my speculation.
The memo does not say to exclude that part of the clause, though. It says to exclude the whole thing. The General Services Administration did not answer NPR's questions about why that clause was removed. In a statement, GSA spokesperson Will Powell said, quote, GSA has taken immediate action to fully implement all current executive orders. Melissa Murray is a constitutional law professor at NYU. She thinks the removal of the segregated facilities clause is significant.
It's symbolic, but it's incredibly meaningful in its symbolism.
Murray points out there are still federal and state anti-discrimination laws.
The federal government is saying, like, we don't require you as contractors to have integrated facilities. It's fine if you have segregated facilities, but that, of course, would make an employer non-compliant with the terms of the Civil Rights Act.
She explains that these provisions were part of the federal government's efforts to facilitate racial integration.
The fact that they are now excluding those provisions from the requirements for federal contractors I think, speaks volumes.
She says her father, a Jamaican immigrant studying at Howard University in the 1950s, worked in the stockroom at a Washington, D.C. department store because Black people weren't allowed to work on the sales floor. When it comes to segregation in America, she says, it's not far removed at all. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News, Washington.
The novelist Abdulrazak Gurna was just starting a new book when he got a call. In 2021, he had won the Nobel Prize in Literature, which was great and all, but the attention meant he had to take a break from writing that book.
I couldn't go back to it. I don't like to work under that kind of pressure.
He eventually returned to those unfinished pages and found there was still a story there that needed to be written. The book is out now. It's called Theft, and he spoke about it with Andrew Limbong, host of NPR's Book of the Day podcast.
It's the 90s, and Tanzania is open for business. The government recently dropped foreign exchange restrictions, and so tourists are flocking to Zanzibar, its island just off the coast of East Africa. Here's Abdulrazak Gurna, who was born on the island.
And suddenly, tourism just became big money. All kinds of new hotels, new people, NGOs.
Of course, tourists usually come with some baggage. Gurna said some beaches and restaurants became exclusively for tourists, no locals allowed. But the tourism boom also changed the story those locals were telling about their own home.
I mean, there are many corruptions. People begin to tell stories that are not true. You know, you see these guides going around saying, this is this, this is that, this is Freddie Mercury lived there. This is, it's all lies. You know, they just make things up just to please them. You do whatever these people want to hear.
This transition time, when allegiances and power balances are all shifting, is when and where Gurna's new book, Theft, takes place. It centers three characters. There's the educated and kind of arrogant Karim, his young wife Fauzia, who suffers from epilepsy, and Badar, a young servant whom Karim and Fauzia treat almost like a younger sibling. They all come from different worlds, and yet all three of them have something in common. Rightfully or wrongfully, they all feel unwanted by their parents in some way.
You know, why was it important to you to like have these characters feel a sense of like rejection so early on?
I suspect a lot of children feel that at some stage. Now, it could be this is an adolescent thing, that as you grow older, you realize when you start having your own children that it isn't true. But in some cases, of course, it's also true that they're not wanted. Like in the case of Badar, nobody wants him.
And people say this to Badar repeatedly. Early on in the book, the woman who takes Badar in as a boy tells him the story of how his mom died when he was a baby and how his father up and left. Gurna writes, quote, "He cried every time she told it. He felt so dirty. She tutted at him when he cried and wiped his tears with her fingers. But then later, she would tell him again, 'We did the best we could for you and God will reward us.'" And so it's a big blow when Badar, finally finding some footing, some stability in his life, is falsely accused of stealing.
I'm so very interested in how people who are powerless save themselves, how it is that they somehow hang on and find a way out.
Gurna's last book, Afterlives, was a grand, multi-generational, statement-making novel about colonialism and violence and war. The kind of novel you'd expect from an author with the biggest literary prize to his name. In comparison, the story he tells in Theft is smaller. Or maybe intimate is the better word.
And I wanted to get it right in the end precisely because I didn't want it to be something that would be to say, hey, here comes Mr. Nobel.
The high drama moments in Theft happen in plain settings, like quiet living rooms or at the front desk of the hotel where Badar ends up working.
I like that. I mean, I like the fact that it's in a heroic lives, but they're also not heroic obstacles. They're regular, everyday, ordinary sort of things.
Theft is a story about people getting jobs, helping a buddy find a place to stay, and figuring out their place in the world. Not to disagree with Mr. Nobel, but the way Gurna writes it, it all comes off as pretty heroic to me. Andrew Limbaugh, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Workday, Workday is an HR and finance platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to propelling organizations, workforces, and industries into the future. Workday, moving business forever forward. From Progressive Insurance, with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It is just before 6 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXC Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or ask your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Sustaining memberships start at $5 per month. Thank you so much. Slight chance of flurries this evening. Our lows overnight 22 to 29. Partly sunny tomorrow with highs in the mid-30s. Breezy north winds gusting up to 30 miles per hour. For Thursday, sunny